And 51551 is our text number. Veronica, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm not bad.
You've been listening all week and indeed last week and reading the stories.
Yes.
And it's brought back memories for you. What happened, Veronica?
It's just terrible, really and truly. It happened to me when I was about 17.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in a place here in Cork called Besborough.
Yeah.
And when I went in, I wanted to come home, but I wouldn't be let. It wouldn't let me. There was a barrage of them at the door when I tried to come home. So I had to stay, and my daughter was born in February. And she was a couple of weeks old when she got sick. And she was taken from there out to Bimbar's house there. And it was in April, the following April, then that I was allowed home. But on condition that I came back when she come back from hospital. So I waited and waited, and there was no answer from them. So I decided then that I'd take the bull by the horns and I'd go on to see for myself. So when I went in, they looked at me as much as to say, well, you're not a fit mother anyway. And they told me that she was gone to Dublin in a very, 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 well, actually, they didn't tell me that, but I went out and I rang Crumlin Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me that they were sorry to have to tell me that my baby passed away 2 days after arriving from Cork, and that she was very, 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 very ill. So.
And Veronica, how long after your baby dying did you find out?
Actually, it was about maybe a month or two, I'd say.
So they never told you. Had to find out yourself for a
second. Yes, I did, yes.
So they never told you?
No, they didn't. And I got literature, and in one of the sentences from the establishment was that they couldn't contact me, or that I had no interest, and to go ahead and lay the baby to rest. And that's what I did. And I was never told, and I had to find out that she's buried in some place in a plot in Glasnevin. And
the Holy Angels plot, is it?
Yeah. And there's a big plaque with her name on it. I got her name on it, but I don't exactly know where. But about she's there, but that's where it is. That's where she's.
So when they took the baby off you, Veronica, did your baby have? She was named.
She was.
Do you want to tell us her first name or
Maria?
Okay, only if it helps. Maria is taken ill and is taken to hospital.
Yeah.
And were you not given updates or said you want to go in and visit your child?
No, I wasn't. Esther, I was not outside the place. No, I was there to find out, and they said no, nothing today. And we had to work there. I was working on night duty as a nurse's aide or whatever, mother's aide. Or.
And that incident, you say you fell pregnant.
Yeah.
And was it your family that insisted you went to this home?
Well, it was actually my doctor.
Your doctor?
Yeah.
But you were quite young, you were only 17.
That's all, yeah.
So your family agreed with this?
It did.
Yeah. But you say you then tried to leave. Why wouldn't they let you leave?
That I can't answer you, that, Joe. I don't know.
And did they physically try to stop you?
Yes, they did. Yeah, they did. And then I was in another part of this place. And I wouldn't go back out to the main building again where they used to have their food, their meals.
Uh-huh.
So the girls used to look after me in the other place to bring the food to me. But they never inquired or came out to see why I wasn't going in there or anything. Do you know?
And your efforts to find your baby?
Yeah.
Did you try and get to the hospital that you were told she was in?
I actually rang them several times. And they after I found out that she had passed away. And this, come visit her. I was told that she was buried in down here in their own graveyard. But no, she wasn't. I can't think of them rightly offhand now, but there was a wonderful couple in Dublin that helped me, and they found out a lot. And then I got a little bit, maybe it was wrong, I got a little bit of hope up. They had the wrong name down, and a different letter in the name. And I thought then that was, maybe she is alive, and maybe it was all a mistake. But it wasn't, it was true. It's just the wrong letter that was put down, that's all.
And the spelling of her name?
Yeah.
But that gave you thought, oh, maybe.
Yeah, I thought. Yeah. There was a little bit of hope, even though I have been, it was in the back of my mind.
Now, you say then, Veronica, you found a letter which indicated that they had tried to contact you to no avail. But
there was no contact with the mother. The mother had made no contact whatsoever. And
they knew where you were.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
You were in their care. They were stopping you from leaving.
Yeah, yeah. Said I had no contact with her. I didn't seem to be interested in her. It was all wrong, Joe. All wrong.
And do you think the nuns deliberately kept you out of
the picture? Somebody did. Somebody in authority did, Joe. It had to be there, Had to be sure. To me, but nobody ever, even in the home, nobody ever said to me, are you going to adopt her? And so, but obviously they knew that she was very sick and that she wasn't going to get better anyway, so they weren't going to put her up for adoption or ask me to put her up for adoption, but.
And do you know what your daughter died from?
A very, very bad heart condition.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when did you discover she was in the Holy Angels plot in Glasnevin?
When I rang Crumlin.
Okay.
They told me where she was. And they gave me the Glasnevin cemetery number.
And were they surprised, Veronica? Were they surprised that you were Maria's mother and you know nothing about it?
Yes, they were, Joe. They were. There was a very kind lady at the hands of the phone. And she was more than shocked. She was.
To be telling you that your daughter had died a few months previously.
Exactly, yeah. A few weeks, actually.
Now, you did great work tracking down your daughter.
I tried. I think I thought I owed her that much. What I mean?
And then when did you first visit the Holy Angels plot? Because you said you then... Erect God made sure her name.
Yes, I do. I do go for her birthday and for Christmas.
And it's a lovely space up in Glasnevin, and it's extraordinarily well kept.
Yeah.
And you ensured that Maria's name was.
Was on it. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And after leaving the mother and baby home, what happened in your life?
I had lost my job. I was working, and I had lost my job, so I had to. Stay at home for a while, and then I got another job, so I held on to that one. Yeah.
And have you had other children?
I have had four children and happily married four kids,
Stay with us, Veronica, if you would, please, because there's other people telling their stories as well.
Yeah.
Mary wants to tell the story of another 17-year-old, Veronica, but it was her aunt. Mary, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe?
How are you?
Oh, it's opened up the old wounds again. I'm over 35 years searching for information on both my aunt and her baby.
Mm-hmm.
The baby was born in Castle Pollard's home on the 13th of December 1950. Sorry, the 4th of October 1950.
Okay.
And after 2 weeks, they transferred the baby to the hospital in Tullamore, where it died on the 13th of December from hydrocephalus and spina bifida. It was...
And what happened to your aunt?
Well, she was allowed to go home. And my grandmother was willing to take her back, but other family members wouldn't allow it. So she virtually has disappeared off the face of the earth. There was a letter in the winter of 1956 or spring of 57 to say that she was married and could she come home for a visit, which I understand was blocked by other family members.
Why would they stop her coming home?
Because of the shame, I presume.
And what was the shame? Sorry.
The shame that she'd been raped and she had a baby.
That's no shame on her.
Well, that's what I'd say. But she disappeared off the face of the earth entirely. I mean, I obviously, you know, I'm not going to give names. Mm. But, you know, she'll be coming up to her 81st birthday on the 18th of July this year. She was born in 1933. So maybe she's out there somewhere. But I think my issue would be that as my aunt and the baby were both minors when they were in Castle Pollard, surely the nuns had some duty of care towards them. Now, they either won't or can't tell me mm-hmm. how they disposed of the body of the baby. I contacted the church in Tullamore, contacted the hospital, contacted all the undertakers, and there seems to be no record whatsoever of what happened to the baby. I also contact the medical schools, and they say they have no record of having received a body, you know, at that time from Tullamore. So, you know, there's no resting place. There's no acknowledgement that this baby existed. And really, you know, until someone can tell me what they've done with the baby and there can be a fitting marker put up acknowledging that, you know, she was a valid human being, mm-hmm. I'm incredibly angry about it.
And did you ever find a death cert for the baby?
Oh, yes, I found the death cert.
Okay.
That's how I know she died at Tullamore Hospital and what she died of.
Well, a death cert is a state document, so that's proof beyond any challenge that this baby did die. You want to know where is the child buried?
I want to know where my cousin is buried. And I think that, you know, as both mother and child were both in the care of the Sacred Hearts Order, sorry, the Sisters of the Sacred Hearts of Jesus and Mary, which is a different order from the Sacred Heart.
And did you go to look for the records of Castle Pollard?
Oh, I spoke to the archivist in Bessborough on a number of occasions, and basically she wouldn't tell me any more than what I already knew.
And what do you... how did you come... If your aunt has refused in 1956, if she writes home from England saying, can I come home, and she's refused, obviously you weren't around then, I suspect. How did you find out?
Around the time, I was about 20, and I was rummaging through old books in my grandmother's house and found a history book, a school book, mm-hmm. which had my mother's name crossed out and this other name written underneath it. You know the way they do when they pass
on a book from
one child to another. And I asked, who is this person? Mm-hmm. And at that stage, I was told, you know, if you make any attempt to contact her, you know, she's dead and you'll be dead too. You no longer exist. You'll be no longer a part of this family. And that, you know, that attitude was there up until my mother and the rest of the family died in the 1980s. And even up to the 1990s, you know, I would have returned to the hometown for kind of anniversary masses mm-hmm. and things like that to be told this town doesn't need scum the likes of ye. From extended family members. So it's still the big secret. You know, nobody's going to talk about it. This is still the big secret.
Stay with us.
And, you know, it has an effect right the way down. Yeah. Because, you know, when you're brought up with everything being a secret like that, it's not a normal upbringing. And it reflects, you know, obviously on your own life later on as well.
Stay with us, Mary. And Veronica, in your case, when your baby was taken to hospital and you couldn't get any information,
yes,
could you appeal to your own parents, to your own family to help?
No, I couldn't, Joe.
Not really. Why, Veronica?
Well, sort of, they were maybe disappointed that it happened and all this sort of thing, you know. Yeah. It's just, you know, they were there, okay, but I don't think, that, you know, that they were taking the word, maybe. I don't know. I can't say, Joe. I don't really know.
And you kept it to yourself?
I did, yeah.
And, Veronica, can I ask, would you have told, were you in communication with the father at that stage?
Definitely, I was, yeah.
Yeah, and did he know his daughter was...
Oh, he does, yeah.
Gone, but did he know at that time that his daughter had gone missing, effectively?
Well, yes, I filled him in when I sort of got home, more or less.
And how did he react?
Well, he was upset and worried, and he brought me to various places, you know, to see how we go about it, finding out things, you know.
Yeah.
He was 100% behind me, yeah.
Yeah. Let me bring Aidan in. Aidan, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe.
And we now, well, Veronica and Mary are of recent, the story that both of them are telling relates to the 60s, but you're telling a story a slightly different angle, but from the late 1980s. What happened, Aidan?
Well, my wife got pregnant with twins, and we were very thrilled about this. We had no children, and we were getting on a bit, and it was a wonderful bit of news for us. But then one night, 8.5 months into her pregnancy, when the people in the room were saying, just, you know, mind yourselves now, and only come back to us if there's a change in movement, a big change in movement. One night, my missus said to me in the bed, the lads have been very quiet today. We knew there were two boys at the time from the scans. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, I said, do you think should we ring the coom? And by 6 a.m., we were there and we knew there were no hearts beating. We had been told that the babies were dead.
Mm-hmm.
And we were asked to come in the following day for a delivery of two dead babies. And that was terribly hard to face. But for both of us. But I concentrated on the business of thinking about getting them baptized. And I went while my wife was heading for the delivery room. Basically, I went looking for the chaplain to sort of say, can you baptize them? And I got him, and he said, but sure, they're dead, Aidan. You can't baptise dead children. And I said, but would they have baptism of desire? And he said, we'd hope so, certainly. And I said, right, okay. And we went ahead, and our doctor said extraordinarily to me that day, he said, have you got a camera? And I said, yeah. And he said, could you bring the camera in for the delivery? And I remember thinking at the time, this is the sickest thing I've ever heard in my life. That, you know, I would take pictures of two dead boys, two dead children. But I did, and I'm so damn glad that I did, because what happened after that was, obviously, my wife feeling dreadful, people in the Coombe Hospital trying to console us, me asking ward sister, what happens next? And she's saying, well, typically the boys would go to Holy Angels plot in Glasnevin.
Mm.
And I said, but, you know, we've got names for them. There would be godparents, four different families are all looking forward. We're all looking forward to them coming, you know. These aren't just two non-entities. These are two people that have lived for 8.5 months inside a womb, and surely people will respect that. And she said, well, no, they're best in Holy Angels. You don't need the hassle now. And I thought, God, you know, burying my own children is not a hassle. So I went down to my home place in the countryside,
mm-hmm.
where my mum and dad were already buried, because both my mum had died very early on when I was 5. And I went down to the parish priest there. This is 1988, Joe. And I said to him, I have 2 wee boys that are going to need burying. And he said, were they baptised, Aidan? And I said, no, they weren't. They're dead. And he said, I can't have a funeral for them. And I said, what do you mean you can't have a funeral for them? He said, well, I can't have a funeral mass for them. They were never Christians, Aidan. And I said, what am I going to do with them? And he said, well, I said, they have names. They're Evan and Oisin. And he said, the church won't allow me have a funeral, Aidan. And I said, but can I put them in the plot then? And he said, well, the plot is yours. The plot is your family's. And I said, so can I open the plot and bury them? And he said, well, I won't stand in your way. And bless, I had a lovely aunt and cousins living very close to the graveyard. And a week after they had been delivered dead, started down. No undertakers or anything like that, because no one seemed to want to know. Oh, yeah, there had to be a post-mortem on them. And this is where the sort of state and church thing comes together for me. Because the post-mortem, we'll say, I haven't given you my second name, but we called me Tully, right?
Yeah, okay.
And what I got were 2 little bits of paper, like bus tickets almost, the post-mortem on baby Tully 1 and baby Tully 2. Yes. And nobody wanted to know a name. And I realised at that stage that the ward sister in the Coombe wasn't just sort of taking the weight off me, sort of, and being helpful, saying they would usually go to Holy Angels. She was basically saying, there is no other place for them to go. And this, I think, is the thing that people aren't understanding here, that the baptism of the children, before they were baptised, if they weren't baptised, they were not people for the Catholic Church then, in 1988. So I bought 1 wee coffin, 1 wee white coffin, and because they'd been together in their mum's tummy for all the time, I decided they should stay together. And I cleaned out my car. I had an old Saab car at the time with a good boot, and I put flowers around the boot, and I started to drive down to the country graveyard, and people that with the boys in the boot on the day that I phoned a couple of people to say that my cousins were opening the grave for them. Mm-hmm. And I went down, and there were about 300 people in the graveyard that day, Joe.
To show their respects.
To show their respect, and from all sorts of bits of the country. But at least I had 10 sets of husbands and wives come up to me that time and say, well, we had a stillbirth. And we, the husband saying, I had to go in the middle of the night and bury it myself. Like, Ireland is peppered with what lovely person on your show yesterday was calling relegines.
Yeah.
Unofficial, unconsecrated ground, where the babies that couldn't be put in consecrated ground were buried. And then for me, the final indignity of the thing was that I knew the company that had done the gravestone for my mum and dad. And I went back and rang them and said, I have 2 new names to put in the gravestone. And I happened to get the son of the family, a small family business. And he took the details and he said, when was death? And that was difficult. And I said, look, just put a date. You know, he says, when's birth, when's death? I give him the date that they were delivered on. I said, don't put birth or death. Just put a date. For them, okay. Evan and Oisin, and the date. And the next morning, his mother rang. He obviously told his mother this the night. And his mother said, Mr. Mead, I just want to... Oh, God.
Okay,
anyway,
okay.
Mr. Tully, I just wanted to say... ask you, were they baptised?
This was the headstone people, as they say.
The headstone people.
Yes.
The mother of the family business of the headstone
okay.
people. Right?
Yes.
Were they baptised, she said to me. She asked me. And I said, no. And she said, well, now, it wouldn't be appropriate to put their names on the stone, Mr. Mead. They should be in a holy angel's plot, Mr. Mead.
My God.
This is 1988, Joe, right?
Yes.
And I said to her, well, if I have to scrape it with a penknife myself, I will put their names on the stone. And bless them, finally, they did. And for me, there's an end to this. Like, we ended up getting through that, right?
Yes.
And coming out the other side and deciding to adopt, right?
Yeah.
And I had worked for bits and pieces of time in Peru. I just loved the people and I loved the children. We were getting on a bit, and as far as Irish adoption agencies, we didn't have a chance really. But there were lots of children stuck in orphanages in a town in northern Peru called Trujillo. And Trujillo had the Cork Diocesan Mission to it. And the Bon Secours sisters from Cork, presumably originally, had been sent out with the priests to Trujillo originally, I suppose to make the rations and sausages for them for a start, to mind the boys. But the Bon Secours had ended up building the first maternity hospital there and building the first schools there. And they were a huge help to myself and my wife in terms of adopting three small children. Do you know, I'd hate the Bon Secours to become the butt of shock and horror in Ireland. That there is the law that was, what do you call it, the Catholic law, canon law. Canon law was a cruel and unforgiving thing. If you remember, those children were supposed to go not to heaven, they were supposed to go to limbo at the time.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
They weren't. You weren't even to have the consolation as a mother like Veronica to think my child is in heaven, you know? It's just so sad, Veronica, if you're still listening, to think of how you were treated and how the women were treated under canon law.
Well, let me add, Veronica, were you given a date that your baby died on?
Yeah, the 17th of July.
Okay, they gave you, did you manage, on the Holy Angels plot, are you allowed to put a date on as well?
Yeah.
Okay. So that would have made her how many weeks old?
She was 8 months, I think.
She was 8 months.
5 months.
So she was, but she was baptized.
She was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And Veronica, how often do you manage to get to Dublin? Or
I do. I do get definitely on her birthday, and sometimes at Christmas or on our anniversary. I do sort of, you know, but definitely. On her birthday.
And Veronica, afterwards, and I'm thinking from what you said a long time afterwards, did your family ever speak about it?
Yes, I told them about it. It was actually my daughter that encouraged me to ring.
Okay.
Yeah, they're brilliant.
But they're your daughter's grandparents, I mean, did they ever speak about it?
Oh, well, I told them, my mother, Larry Gotour, I told my mother, my sisters knew now, they were supportive as well. I told my mother, maybe it was all for the better, you know, that's sort of an answer, you know.
And Mary, who's been trying to track down her aunt. What? But by the way, Mary, you can give me your aunt's first name if you wish.
She was Mary Carmel, but known as Carmel.
Carmel, okay.
And the baby was Mary Teresa. But again, half the babies coming out of Castle Pollard at the time were Mary Teresa.
And the date of the baby's birth?
The date of the baby's birth was the 4th of October, 1950.
Okay. Let me ring a bell.
Can I just say to you, Joe,
yeah.
By 1950, the shunts were available for babies, you know, born with hydrocephalus and spina bifida. And, you know, I have huge questions as to why that baby was left in Castle Pollard for a fortnight before the transfer to hospital. And again, there doesn't seem to be any medical records available. And I would have had to go through the birth of my own two older children without knowledge that there was, you know, anything in the family that, you know, would have any negative impact on a pregnancy of my own, you know?
And I just, from what you said earlier, Mary, you've made lots of efforts to try and track down Carmel, haven't you?
Over 30... I mean, I've walked the Fulham Road from one end to another because somebody from the town she lived in had a relative, a musician, who said that he had spotted her in the White Hart pub in Fulham around the late 1968-69. So, you know, and the possibility that she may have been running a picture framing business or a camera shop in that area... You know, we walked the Fulham Road trying to track down, you know, any possibility of her existence. But she has just disappeared off the face of the earth.
Yeah. And yeah, so therefore you've tried marriage. You've tried marriage certs, birth,
marriages, death
certs,
deaths, passenger lists, assisted passage to Australia lists, births of, you know, births where the mother has the same surname.
And do we know Carmel's birth date?
18th of July, 1933.
So she's just coming up to her...
81st birthday.
Okay, next month.
And I'm looking back. It's 36, 37 years I've been looking. Yeah. You know, long before there was ever an internet, I would have paid people to go to Somerset House every year and check, you know, check births, check marriages, check births of a mother with the correct surname, check deaths. Obviously, with the internet, I have it posted, you know, on every possible website right the way, you know, across the internet. There's only one other member of the family has any interest in, you know, in finding her. But really, most of the family are dead and gone at this stage. Yeah. And when we're dead and gone, you know, unless my kids carry her legacy, and I kind of wouldn't wish that on them because, you know, every time something comes up to do with, you know, mother and baby homes or, you know, any of this sort of stuff, it's a piece of your life that's missing. You know, there's a child out there whose existence has never been really acknowledged. There's a mother out there who has been so badly treated, not just by her family, but by the state, by the church, you know, by the country of Ireland. You know, there's an apology due, and it's bigger than any that I'd ever be able to give her. But I'd never, you know, I would never be able to make restitution for what was done to that woman.
Okay.
Well, to that child, as she was at the time.
Aidan, Veronica and Mary, stay with us because people want to ask you more questions. After this break, 51551 is our number. And from the UK, it's 00353120822984. And on the internet, it's joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Aidan, I wonder, did any priest or cleric ever listen to your story as you told it so powerfully here subsequently and react?
I got lovely reaction at close to the time, Joe, because I wrote a letter to the Irish Times at the time. There had been one of the pro-life referenda had happened earlier on, and I had written a letter basically that said, isn't it extraordinary, no matter what kind of experience you have as a woman in Ireland with Catholicism as it was then, it seems you get a rap on the knuckles because if you were 18 and pregnant and went for an abortion, they were clear at that stage that you were committing murder, you know, you were murdering a person. But if you went along with your two dead babies whom I still have a photograph of in my wallet, and said, "Can you bury them, please?" They said, "But they're not Christians. They're not people. We can't bury them." And when Archbishop Dermot Martin says there isn't any mass graves around, of course he's right. There are mass plots around, the Holy Angels' plots, and the unidentified graveyards. Like, I had one very good friend whose baby, his wife was a nurse, God love her, and the baby lasted, I think, 2 days before the baby died. And the man, the husband, told, "It's your job now to take this corpse and bring it to the unmarked grave and get rid of it. Bury it, make it disappear. Because it doesn't fit in Ireland. It doesn't fit anywhere."
Alan is on the line. Stay there, Aidan, Veronica, Mary. Alan, good afternoon.
Yes, hello. Yes,
Alan Rooney. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm just listening to all those stories. I'm a bit sad. I'm glad mine wasn't that way.
And what was your story, Alan? What is your story?
Well, I fell pregnant at the end of 1989 with my daughter.
Right.
At the time, I'm from an Irish family. We'd moved back to Ireland in the 70s, and then my mum had just moved over here to France, maybe it was looking for me, 1989. And then I discovered that I was pregnant when I was over here on holidays. Uh-huh. And I went back there to work. I didn't tell anyone, well, my mum knew. And then I went back to work in London, there in a private school from February till April. And then at that time, I hadn't told anyone, but I was inquiring from a cousin who herself had been adopted to know. I didn't tell her I was pregnant, but I was just asking her, you know, did you ever go to meet her mother? And she told me that she'd gone once to meet her mother when she was about 18, and then they didn't sort of continue their relationship. And then I had another cousin who'd had a baby and had it adopted as well. So I'd been trying to find out different things about adoption, but at the same time, you're sort of having to keep quiet all the time about it, or, you know, not tell anyone. Mm-hmm. And then, so then it meant for me in my pregnancy that I was always going through things like telling my baby, you know, I can't keep you, I'll have to give you up, and trying to tell her things about me because I was thinking about having her adopted. And that was the kind of idea that people that did have, that's the idea that people had around me. And then in the end, I didn't. I know that up until the end, my mum would have liked me to have had her fostered or adopted. And she never really was able to speak about it. I think it was too difficult for her. And then I think it's a whole thing that comes from, it's not bad, it's just something that comes from Irish life and being Catholic. Or in, I don't know, it's just the whole thing, isn't it? And at that time, when I was in school in Middleton, I know of other girls that had fallen pregnant, we knew about it, and they disappeared to Dublin, and then they came back and they weren't pregnant anymore. So it was just the kind of thing that you did, that if you were unmarried and pregnant, well, then the baby was adopted.
Yeah, but this is... Then, Alan, it's 1989. We're talking.
Yeah, 1990, yes, I know. It's not really that far away, no. But I mean, that is, it was still that climate round Cork anyway.
And what age were you, Alan?
I was 27. Yeah. So I wasn't young, but I wasn't too old either.
And but you still felt the pressure, and you felt from what happened to your peers at the time that this adoption and the baby.
Yeah, I did. I felt,
You felt that pressure.
Yes, I did. I think that if we had carried on living in Middleton, that maybe I finally would have ended up believing that that was best for her, was to give her up, and that way she would have a proper home with two parents and things like that. I just remember all the silence about the whole thing of not being able to say it to somebody. But maybe it was me that was living it that way, but just felt I had to remain silent. I don't know.
And can I ask you, Ellen, because you're Irish, London, then France, the connections, So you had a young baby when you were living in France and you were a lone parent or whatever. What was the attitude there?
It's kind of mixed. I think in a way, because I wasn't fluent in French, that I was kind of protected from the reality of everything by being in another language. Because in later years, I have heard people saying about one man I was working with, that he had had to marry a woman as if because she fell pregnant, you know, by accident, and that was only 12 years ago. So I think there was still a little bit of it here as well, but I wasn't fully aware of it at first. Yeah. But at the same time, people here were a lot more open than in Ireland about couples living together and having children. But there is still a little thing that remains for children when they have the same name as the mother, but the father's name isn't there. Yeah.
So even
there's still a little bit of that here.
Yeah.
And but I'm living sort of in the countryside here, so yes, that could be something to do with it.
And stay with us if you would, Ellen, and indeed Mary and Veronica, because I want to ask you a few more questions, and I've Noel as well after this break. 51551.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 8155.
And the power of Aidan talking about his two children, Evan and Oisín, is ringing for a lot of people. Thank you, Aidan. Let me go to Noel. Noel Brown. Noel, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How
are you?
You're
listening to Mary and Veronica and Ellen, and it's...
Yeah, I am indeed. I didn't hear your show yesterday, but my colleague in the show that I'm doing at the minute, Brittany Nocken, told me about it, and I've been following up on, obviously, the newspaper reports and everything else. But what struck me about your callers there was that difficulty, which I experienced when I went to trace my birth family, just getting information. You know, I started in 2002, and even then, I was met with stone walls. You know, the nuns were still there that had handed me over. And it was just like, no, you cannot have any information. And those poor people, you know what I mean? You're desperate for any kind of information.
And where were you born? Where were you born, Noel?
I was born in Besper in Cork. So it would have been the Bonscour nuns as well.
And when did you discover you were born in Cork?
I've always known I was adopted. You know, I grew up in a lovely family. I was one of the lucky ones, I suppose. But I was told that I was born in Dublin. So for years, I thought I was born in Dublin. And it's only when I actually found some of my birth family, I was able to verify that I was born in Besper, which was about, you know, half a mile from where I grew up.
And why were people telling you were born in Dublin?
Well, that's the problem, Joe. I mean, whatever information you get, and you know, when you see your adoption file, you imagine it's going to be full of information, and what you get is fiction created by the nuns in 1965, which is the year I was born. Things like born in Dublin, vague details, you know about the kind of person your mother was. Not the right name, sort of a brief description of a father, which doesn't bear any relation to the truth either. So you have all these kind of bits of information that are invented. So you're already on the wrong track and you become like a detective, which is something I use in the play as well as a kind of a device. And you're constantly relying on people to give you information and fighting authority to get information. And it really is. It just makes me so angry that in this day and age, people don't have access to that information. Those files are sitting in convents around the country and people are desperate for information. We've just been on tour with Postscript for the last 5 weeks, meeting so many birth parents and adopted children who were, you know, had the same experience I had. There are some good experiences, but in general, it's been very bad. I've had contact from adopted children in America who were shipped over there, who contacted me on Facebook and Twitter and everything else to talk about the play. And it's just, I mean, you know, what happened in Tuam is beyond belief. It is appalling. And the most we are given is, oh, we'll ask for an inquiry. An inquiry isn't good enough. You know, it has to be an investigation, because out of that, hopefully, will come the fact that those files have to be given up and given to people. As an adopted person in Ireland, and even as a birth mother, you're just second-class citizens. Still, in 2014, you know, to get a birth cert, you have no access to your birth cert. We're the only country in the world where you cannot get a birth cert. Even though if you've traced your family and you have all the information, You know, I got my birth cert by going in, using my birth name, pretending to be somebody. You know what I mean? That was the only way I could get it. We're so far behind the times. And this appalling incident in Tuam, where it's like we'll go, will we have an inquiry? Will we not have an inquiry? It's just inhuman, you know? But this country needs to wake up. And I mean society in general. You know, we can bash the church as much as we want to, but society is part of this. You know, there were people working in those homes. There were people with information out there that won't give up that information. And it is time we did and end people's suffering, because it is a suffering. That poor woman earlier talking about trying to contact her daughter. You know, they've just actively put obstacles in the way of these women and children. And it is just, you know, it's criminal. It is criminal, and it needs to be looked at.
Say with us, Noel. Veronica, did you ever ask the nuns for an explanation?
No. Well, I tried ringing them, Joe, after coming out. But there was a fire at some stage, I was told, and a lot of the records were broken or was burned, you know, but you wouldn't be given an answer, Joe, even. And I agree wholeheartedly with the lady there.
Well,
yeah.
It's deliberately lack of cooperation.
That's true.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Veronica, would you, what consoles you now? I know you have your children and your grandchildren, and what consoles you now when you think about Maria?
Oh, well, at least now, Joe, that everything seemingly is coming out in the open, and I can talk about it, and I can talk about the hardships and pains that everybody and the likes of me and everybody else went through. And I know she's in Dublin, in a graveyard in Dublin, but why didn't they not tell me about it? That's just the heartbreaking part of it. They couldn't have told me where she was or that she had passed away. You know, that's the heartbreaking part of it, Joe. That I couldn't take her home and look after it myself. That strange people, like, who paid for this? Do you know what I mean? Who paid for all this? That's another thing. Like, she had to be buried. Somebody had to bury her.
Who brought her to the graveyard? Was there a ceremony, a mass? Was there?
Yeah, I don't know that, Joe. I don't know. You know, that's another thing. Why were they hiding it? Why did they hide it from me? You know, and let me believe that, you know, that she was out there for a while. But she wasn't when I found out.
That she had died.
Yeah.
Okay. And is your husband still alive?
He is, yeah.
Okay.
So
you've lots of support around you, Veronica.
I have, that's one thing. My daughters are brilliant, My husband is too. But my daughters are brilliant, you know.
And I'd say you brought up the best in them and you bring out.
I suppose so.
Veronica, thanks indeed.
You're very welcome, John. Thank you for hearing this problem, and I hope that maybe somebody will, that are out there, that are needs to look for, you know, I hope to get some support from today. But it's a terrible thing that's after happened in June, but it's, you know, it's heartbreaking, and until there's an answer and something got from it, it's, you know. Thanks a million, Joe.
Okay, well, God bless Maria.
And you too. God bless.
And may she rest in peace, safe in your arms.
Please, God, she is, Joe.
In your arms.
Yeah. God bless you, and thank you very much.
Joe Duffy! Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And my thanks to Noel, Mary, and Ellen before the break. Marie, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe, how are you?
Good, you're listening.
I am. I listen every day. like your programme.
And you're saying your heart goes out to Aidan and to Veronica and the stories that they're telling.
It does, Joe, because you can hear the pain in their voices, obviously, but it just brings back a lot of memories for me too. Not for me personally, but my sister.
Yeah.
My sister had a baby in the 1970s, and it was in one of the homes, you know, for the unmarried mothers.
The mother and baby homes, they were called, yeah.
Pardon?
The mother and baby homes, they were
yes,
called.
Yes, I think that's what they were, Joe, yeah. You know. But I was married. I was a young married mother at the time. I had four young babies because I was married very young myself. So we all tried to help, but the decision was made anyway to let her go in here and have our baby in here, and the baby was adopted after a year. And we never expected to see him again. We had seen him when he was born, but we'd visit him, sort of. I used to go up quite a bit, but he was adopted eventually, and unfortunately my sister got breast cancer, and she was very ill in around 2001. She was extremely ill, so we knew she hadn't got much time. So a member of my family approached the sisters, I'm not sure of the name of the order, and they found her son, and she got to meet him just before she died. So at this stage now, he's in touch with all the family, and we're very happy to know him. He's a lovely lad.
And what age was he when he met his mother?
He would have been 2001, that's 13 years. He would have been about 24, maybe.
Okay.
He would have been, like, he had a child of his own at this stage. He'd a little girl.
But your sister was very young then when she died.
She was very young, yeah. She was around 19, 20, around that age, you know. So it was just a tragic story, really, because in hindsight, it's kind of, this is much later now. My children are all grown up. I had six children. I feel I should have maybe fought a little bit to, you know, hang on to him, because we all, at that stage, I don't know, she was just packed off to this place anyway, and we really didn't think we'd see him again, although he did get to where, and I've been able to tell him since, he did get to wear my children's, you know, the christening robe that the children wear when they're baptised. But it was also strict, and she was broken-hearted anyway. She just constantly, you know, wanted to see him. And eventually she got her wish, but it was a little late, you know.
Yeah. And as you say, she was 43 when she died, incredibly young. He was just in his early 20s when they met for the first time.
That's right.
But you, when all this was happening, Marie, this is, I think, what's upsetting you, is that you were of an age.
Yes.
Where you feel now.
Yeah.
And by the way, you had four young children, so there's no blame or guilt here.
At that time I had two more later, yeah.
But I'm saying you feel, I was of an age, should you have done, this is the... And there's no blame. City should be sitting on your shoulders.
Yeah. I just feel now, because I'm as you say, I'm of an age now, that maybe I could have done something, like, to keep the baby in the family. But I am the oldest of a big family, but I was, you know, very young. And, you know, when you think in later years, it's different when you think back and you say, my God, how did we let that happen? It would never happen nowadays, you know. It just wouldn't happen because, you know, people just, well, they don't give their babies away. She didn't actually give them away. She was more or less forced into it. You know, I don't want to go into all the details, but as I said, there was a lot of stigma attached to it. So when I read this thing, you know, during the week, or heard it on the news about the 800 babies and mothers, I was shocked to the core, because you really don't know what went on in those homes, you know. And I do hope there's an investigation into it, because, you know, it deserves to be investigated, you know.
Stay with us, Marie. Father Joe MacDonald is on the line. He's been listening. Joe, good afternoon.
Hiya, Joe. Thanks for taking the call. Joe, I was in two minds to ring or not, because I'm not sure I even have the words to say this. I find I just by chance was listening in this afternoon up in Liffey Valley, heading in to get a few bits and pieces, and I haven't moved from the car. I am so upset by what I'm hearing. Absolutely heartbreak. And I know one of the things that stopped me ringing you, Joe, was that in one way, maybe the last person people want to hear today on your show is a priest, and I can understand that. But I think the other side of it that prompted me to ring you is just, are we being silent again? You know, can you not hear us again for all the different reasons we have of not speaking? I just want to say that, you know, my heart goes out. I am absolutely, it's a long time, Joe, since I was so upset. I'd just like to say that I really feel for all the people who contributed yesterday and today. It's very difficult to know what to offer, if to offer anything. And maybe it's doing just what you do, which is to honour the story and to listen. And maybe guys like me should shut up today and just listen. But I do want to say that my heart goes out to them. Certainly here in St. Matthew's, if we could do anything that would help. And I mean simply by gathering and asking for forgiveness, you know, some act of genuine remorse. And I hear a number of people talking about investigation, and definitely that people are entitled to that. And anybody that has records, that has information, whether it be priest, brother, nun, it makes no difference at all. We should cut out all the nonsense about that and make that freely available without question, and stop contributing to people's abject pain and sorrow. Mm-hmm. And it sounds trite, Joe, but just to finish on this, you know, I'm seriously thinking of saying, could we offer, just open the church some night and come in and pray and light a candle and name some of these children, for people to come in and name. Now, Joe, I know there are people who say, Father, with respect to you, the last place I'm going to is the church. And I understand that, you know, and I think we should be taking that, and we deserve that in some sense. But I suppose at the same time, Joe, maybe people, I've heard people again and again on your show, and they've surprised me that even with the most appalling hurt and damage done by the church, some people manage to retain some faith in God. I suppose if I thought it was helpful, you know, that I'd say, well, you know, open the church in St. Matthew's and let's just have a vigil for the lost, innocent, beautiful boys and girls that didn't get the respect and the love that they deserved, particularly from church and particularly from institutional church. And that we would ask in that, you know, ask of God and the people who would gather, we would ask for genuine forgiveness and to be serious and to be honest about our repentance. Now, look, for what it's worth, Joe, that's just what I wanted to offer. Well,
and I think it's worth a lot, Joe, I really do. I really do. I think because I've been saying to myself during the programme, I wonder, is there a priest who's listened? I know there's so many good priests out there, but I just wonder, is there a priest listening who would speak? And I thank you for those words and the offer as well to people. And the offer is much more than a venue. The offer is one almost of redemption. That's Father John MacDonald Joe's in St. Matthew's there in Ballyferm. More people after this break.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Marion, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. How are you? You were...
Oh, well, I think we're all a bit... not shocked, but emotional this week. Yeah.
You were in Bessborough.
I actually wasn't there for long. I spent most of my time, I was pregnant at 17. Mm-hmm. And I spent, well, when I got pregnant, I kept it to myself. I was afraid to tell my family, of course I was. You don't get pregnant in those days. And I kept the story to myself. And eventually I approached, when I couldn't keep it to myself any longer,
I approached a teacher who was very, very, always very good to me. She's dead now, God rest her soul. I went to her for help, and she took me to a doctor. Like, I was so, I suppose, ignorant at the time. I was taking iron tablets, thinking I was bloodless. And she took me to the doctor. Eventually, I knew I was pregnant. She got it confirmed. I was young, 20 weeks, and the person that I thought would be best to tell my parents was a nun. At the time, she was a very good friend of the family, and we did. We met her and we told her, and she sent for my mum and dad. And I remember being sitting in my teacher's car outside in the hospital in St. Finbar's in Cork, and I could see my mum going in and coming out, and I was terrified, and I went home and all hell broke loose. So to cut a very long story short, I was put up into my bedroom for the rest of my pregnancy. We owned a public house in Cork at the time, and the customers used to have to come through the house to go to the ladies or gents or ladies at the time. And I was left upstairs all day, every day. I could only come down at night when the pub was shut. And then I was told I was going to have a nun from St. Finbar's. I won't mention her. She's dead now, God rest her. She used to bring me out once a month to see a doctor, a gynaecologist, during the famous holy hour at the time. And I'd be back up in my bedroom. It used to happen between 2:30 and 3:30. And I'd be back in my bedroom before the pub opened again. So nobody saw me, and everybody was told I had a growth in my stomach from lifting barrels. I used to bless my stomach every night, my baby, and pray for him. It was horrendous. It was a terrible time in my life. I was left alone. I had two young sisters, younger than me, that were powerless to do anything, really.
And was the baby taken from you?
He was induced way before his time, up in St. Finbar's. And I was taken from there. I had a horrible delivery. It was horrendous. And I was taken. He was born in the early hours of the morning, little boy. 1974, this was. And I was taken from there by ambulance down to Besborough, clipped and stitched, and didn't know what the hell was after happening to me because I was only a child. And I was told I was under 21, I had no rights.
And your boy was taken off you?
From the back of an ambulance. They opened the ambulance. I thought the nun was helping me to get out of the ambulance because I couldn't walk. My two eyes were full of bloodshot. I was stitched and clipped. And I thought she was helping me. She took my baby and walked away. And I was put upstairs into a bed on my own.
And when did you see your baby again?
I actually spent years going up and down to Vesper. Years. Mm. And I was told I had to wait until he was 18. And in fairness, at 18, I got a photograph of him. His adopted mum sent it.
Okay.
And I'm grateful to her for that.
And have you met him?
I met him 14 years ago and he wasn't ready. But thank God, he contacted me after Christmas.
Right.
And we have been in contact. I've met him.
Great.
I met him a few weeks ago.
Well done.
But for years, I thought, is he dead? Is he alive? Every child I looked at, is that my baby?
Yeah.
It was horrendous.
Okay.
Absolutely horrendous. And my adoption papers were signed and I have no recollection of it. And they were all changed. The first paper was signed 2 days after the birth of my baby. I have no recollection whatsoever.
So, Marion, I'm glad you've met. Thank you for contacting us. I'm out of time, unfortunately.
I know that, John.
And there's so many other people I want to apologise to as well who are trying to talk. Thank you indeed, Marion, and many, many more years of happiness with you and all your family.